Up next on Downtown, Ken Burns got a brand new film coming out, the latest in his, more than 30 years of telling the story of America, Jackie Robinson, the subject of this new film. And Ken, you've said that Jackie Robinson, in your opinion, is the most important person in the history of baseball. Is it crossing the color line, or is it the way he dealt with that that made him such a landmark figure?
Well, I think it's a combination. You can't sort of separate the action from the reaction and from the character, from the person. He's not the best baseball player, but he is by far the most important baseball player that's ever lived because he made the national pastime, in fact, what it had always claimed to be, the national pastime. It had systematically for many decades excluded African-Americans from playing, and when he crossed the color line, broke the color line on April 15th, 1947, it was the beginning of the modern civil rights era. Martin Luther King was still a junior in Morehouse College. Harry Truman hadn't integrated the military. Brown versus Board of Education outlawing school segregation hadn't happened. There were no organized lunch counter sit-ins. Rosa Parks was a decade away from refusing to give up her seat on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. So Jackie Robinson is a pioneer. Martin Luther King said he was a sit-inner before sit-ins and a freedom rider before freedom rides. And he is the only athlete in any sport in which his number is retired across all teams, and which no one is permitted to wear his number except on April 15th, when every player must wear his number on every single team. And that's an extraordinarily powerful, moving testament to what Jackie Robinson accomplished.
In telling the story of Jackie Robinson, how important was it for you to have the opportunity to speak with Rachel Robinson?
Oh, I don't think we could have made the film without her. She, in fact, had been the one that had been urging me to do a standalone treatment of Jackie. He had been a central figure, the central figure in our 9-episode, 18-and-a-half-hour 1994 series called Baseball. But she thought, quite correctly, he deserved standalone treatment, and she urged me over many, many years to do it, and finally we did. But, of course, she had to be, as far as I was concerned, as far as my co-producers and co-directors Sarah Burns and David McMahon were concerned, she had to be at the center of it. And she not only generously gave of her time and of the archives the Jackie Robinson Foundation, which she started, had, but she, you know, led us into her heart, gave us access to one of the most powerful love stories I know, not without complications, to one of the most amazing, multi-generational stories of an African-American family, not without tragedy along with the triumph. And that's very generous. She's 93 years old. She's lived more of her life without Jackie than with him, and she didn't have to do this, but she wanted a complex thing. You know, Jackie's been so smothered in myth for the last several decades that he becomes kind of one-dimensional, and what we tried to do in this film is liberate him from that one-dimensionality and show him as a real person, complicated, flawed, but in fact, that in no way diminished the greatness of what he accomplished. In fact, I think it makes it even more inspiring, because nobody's perfect. None of us know a perfect person. And the more we transform our heroes into superficial kind of conventional wisdom heroes, we do them and ourselves a disservice.
Well, you mentioned the mythology, and as often the case in your films, you uncovered a lot of misunderstandings and outright fictions about Jackie Robinson. Was the Pee-wee Reese story the biggest fiction that you uncovered?
No, but I think it's the most obvious one, because this is a trope that we've been, you know, promoting. I mean, we did. We told this story in our 1994 baseball series, told to us by other people who should have known better, the famous moment in his first season when they're traveling to Crosley Field in Cincinnati, home of the Cincinnati Reds. It's particularly virulent, and racist abuse is being showered down on him. And Pee Wee Reese is supposed to have walked over and put his arm around him in a show of solidarity. Well, it didn't happen. If it happened, it happened many years later and kind of migrated back to that first year. That first year, Jackie was playing first. He was always at shortstop, which meant he would have had to walk across the diamond, very unlikely. There's no mention of it in Jackie's autobiography, which paid particular attention to those white people who had been kind to him, who'd helped him along, who'd sort of, you know, gotten his back. There's no mention of it in the white press that day, and there's no mention of it in the black press, which would have run 20 related stories. And in fact, Rachel said when they were building a statue to this non-existent event outside what is now Great American Ballpark in Cincinnati, she begged them not to do that and said you know, use a different image, that one in which you could verify it. There's no image of it. So I think it's one of those things where white people wanted to, you know, participate in this story to show that they were right thinking, to show that they were good. And it's a very wonderful myth in a way, but it's also not true.
We're talking with Ken Burns on Downtown. Jackie Robinson, the two-part, four-hour series begins April 11th on PBS. Ken, should people here in Maine be justifiably proud of the role of Clyde Sukeforth in the Jackie Robinson story?
Oh, you should. You know, I can remember as if it was yesterday an interview I did in West Waldoboro, Maine, in, I guess it was 1992. I took my then young daughter, Sarah Burns, who was not quite 10 years old, with me along on the trip as Clyde told the story of this being dispatched by Branch Rickey to Chicago to watch Jackie Robinson play, and bringing Jackie Robinson back for the now famous meeting on Montague Street in Brooklyn Heights, downtown Brooklyn, with Branch Rickey, in which the deal was made that Jackie would turn the other cheek and that he would be brought first into their farm club. Now, I am very proud to say that this film is both directed and produced by David McMahon and that little girl, now grown up and a mother of her own, Sarah Burns, and myself. She and her husband, David McMahon, are the authors. I'm with them, the co-producer and the co-director, but they wrote this. So it's an amazing thing, and Clyde is what connects us. And there are very few instances in our film where we've gone back to earlier interviews to pull people up, Buck O'Neill and Red Barber being the other two, Clyde Sukeforth, who is in more than anyone else from that earlier film, and decided, because they've all passed, Buck O'Neill, the old Major Leaguer, and Red Barber, the Dodger, famous Dodger broadcaster, and Clyde, that we wanted to, if you will, resurrect them for the purposes of this film. And Clyde we use more than anyone else, just because he was there in at the moment when the possibility that an African-American would join Major League Baseball, first the Montreal Royals and then the Brooklyn Dodgers, and change baseball forever. It's a great story, and everyone, not just in Maine, but everyone in the United States should be proud of the story and grateful for Clyde's honesty and memory and directness and modesty. That was the thing I remember most about him.
In your companion book to the baseball series, you talked about the role of Native Americans getting into Major League Baseball. Why is the story of Maine's Louis Sock Alexis not received the attention that certainly a Jackie Robinson has?
It's so funny that you said that. I don't feel that, because we gave him, you know, prominent attention in our baseball series and in our companion book. And it's so interesting that earlier today I had a conversation with someone who had been instrumental in trying to convince the Redskins to change their name, something I agreed with, but I didn't agree with changing the name of the Indians, because it used to be the Cleveland Spiders, but it was the death of Louis Sock Alexis that prompted them, out of grief, out of fandom's grief, to change their name to the Cleveland Indians. So it's honoring. Now maybe you could quibble and say what that Indian head looks like, reflects a more racist view, and maybe the mascot could be changed, or the logo could be changed a little bit. But it was interesting. I had a conversation about Louis Sock Alexis. I don't think I've ever had two conversations about Louis Sock Alexis in one day. So maybe he's not as forgotten as you worry.
We've talked before about race being the central issue in American history, and certainly, if nothing else, this election season demonstrates yet again that we're far from being in a post-racial America.
Yeah, no, we're not going to be in a post-racial America for an awfully long time. And I knew that even when Barack Obama was elected in 2008. You might remember the satirical magazine, The Onion, when he was inaugurated in January 2009. Its headline was not celebratory. It just said, "Black man given worst job in world." And that was just telling you that watch out, because people are going to, it's going to raise not only the pride of Americans who believe, as Lincoln did, in the better angels of our nature, but it's also going to bring out those, how shall we put it, unreconstructed brethren who somehow still don't think African Americans are equal to others. So, you know, I'm not sure if it's the sub-theme. I think the nature of freedom and the tensions between a collective freedom, what we all want, and an individual freedom, what I want, has always been a part of it, what the definition of freedom is. But the next one is race. We were founded on the creed that all men are created equal, but the guy who wrote that sentence, Thomas Jefferson, owned more than 100 human beings. Everything that came before the Civil War, 45 years after he wrote those words, were a product of that contradiction, that hypocrisy, and so much of what's followed has been a consequence of it. And a lot of people have criticized me for bringing it up, and I said, I don't go looking for it. It's just there. If you're interested, as I am, in understanding how my country works, you're going to bump into race. I think I've done, you know, 26, 27 films, and three of them that I can think of, Frank Lloyd Wright and the Horatio's Drive and the Dust Bowl, don't overtly deal with race. But that's not because I'm looking for it. It's just present. And I think we have to be honest with ourselves. And as much as we want to pretend that that's the case, I think, you know, what's nice is that people haven't criticized me for the last few years. But unfortunately, the reason why they haven't criticized me is that picture has become clear. And it reminds us that human progress isn't always a straight line, that you take a couple steps forward and maybe a step backward. And I think we're in a retrograde moment where the bullies and the demagogues are able to shout fire in a crowded theater and arouse people out of fear, trying to convince them that, you know, the other is eating off their plate or taking away their job. And it's just not true. You know, I mean, we have an immigration situation and a big controversy, but nobody's explored it. Did you know that there is a net loss of Mexicans? That is to say, there are more Mexicans returning back to Mexico than are coming over here. And those that do come over here commit crimes at one-third the per capita times that sort of already arrived Americans do. So all of a sudden, if you're suddenly screaming about how bad those immigrants are, and you suddenly can take a breath and go, oh, wait a second, maybe it's not that bad. Or you say, the economy's in the shambles, everything's going to hell in a handbasket, and then find out, well, we've had 72 straight months of job growth, that we have a vibrant auto industry which was in repair, we have 20 million people who are insured that weren't insured again, and nobody with a pre-existing condition and can have their insurance denied, and that capitalism didn't fail, it actually survived. So maybe you can quibble with somebody over policy decisions or the way they acted on this event or that event. That's very American to do that. But if it's just wrong because of the color of the skin, then we still have a lot of work to do.
So, Ken, before we let you go, what lessons can we learn from the story of Jackie Robinson?
We can learn some of the most positive and heroic stories we know. He's one. This is not just a great baseball story. George Will told me back in 1994. This is not a great American story. This is a great human story. And this is a guy who, against all odds, did something, walked through a door, assumed and took on his shoulders the burdens of an entire race, withstood, you know, thousands of racial slights and abuse, and spent every day of his life, once he'd been charged with this great responsibility, spent every day of his life waking up, trying to make the lives of other people, not just black, but white, better. And he did it, and he said that a life is not worthwhile except in the difference it made in other people's lives. And, you know, a lot of us talk the talk, but he walked the walk. And it's an amazing honor to be able to get close to him and sort of strip him of that sentimentality and that nostalgia, and find out that the real person or the truer person is much more interesting and much more heroic and much more inspiring than we could have ever imagined.
Jackie Robinson premieres April 11th on PBS. Ken Burns, always a delight to talk with you. Thank you so much for making time with us, and we look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.